If I ever meet Jared Leto, I'm going to whoop his kombucha brewing ass. My name is Matthew Kroll.
And it's a dangerous thing to mistake speaking without thought for speaking the truth. My name is Shahir Dowd.
And this is the only podcast about movies, specifically the film Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery.
Shall we peel back the reason why we're sounding so silky and smooth today?
Well, I don't know if it's... I mean, to be honest, I don't know if it's better or worse, but it definitely does sound different. Ladies and gentlemen, Shahir Dowd and I are back in the same room.
That's correct. This is the first time... Was it First Cow? Was the last one we did together? First Cow?
No.
And this is the last time... Was it that long ago?
I think so. We should have looked this up before we started.
We probably should have. But yeah, we are in the same room together for the first time in almost 2 years.
Yeah. Now. Recording. I mean,
we've been in the same room.
Not a lot, to be honest.
It's going to be hilarious if we actually get angry with each other and start yelling.
Oh,
and then,
I know.
And then pass COVID onto each other.
You know what I'm noticing I'm so used to looking at you in a screen when we're talking. Like, eye contact, I'm not sure what the right amount of eye contact is.
I'm looking in all other directions.
We're just sort of like, oh, okay. Because when you do this, everyone listening here, I imagine maybe 70% of you have podcasts.
Yeah.
But so you kind of know the drill. But like you get into a rhythm of things and I just look all around. But like I am speaking to you.
I know.
But it's an odd. We're gonna balance it out. We're gonna get.
It's like
back in the
it's flow. Like we're dating for the first time. It's like we're all a little bit shy.
We should, you know. Oh my god, I just had a good idea.
Okay, was it real?
Well, I don't know. No. If we all of our podcasting friends, if we did speed dating podcasts, not dating, like not actually dating.
No. But you have to like roundtable hosts.
You roundtable hosts with like a Zoom call or something, and you have to discuss a certain thing.
Have you seen that? I've seen it on TikTok or something like that, where you can buzz someone out immediately
as they sit down.
So it's like you'll just hear a voice. And then be like, no, thank you.
Yeah,
we should do that.
Yeah.
But what we do have to do is a couple of emails because people have been writing us in. First off, Merry Christmas to everyone. Happy holidays. We can say that again now, right? Like, it's legal to say Happy Holidays and Merry Christmas.
I forget
which one we're offended at.
I don't know. I don't know. Thank God, though, that the one that's bad is gone and the good one is back. I'm so sick of fake outrage about bullshit.
Yeah.
I cannot be bothered to pay attention.
It's weird, though, because I do say Merry Christmas to people, and I think it disarms people, because are you supposed to not say it, or...
I don't fucking know, man. I was home in New Hampshire for the holidays, and my family celebrates Christmas, though we are not religious at all. It is annual gift-giving day. It is the epitome of the meaning of Jingle All the Way.
Yeah.
And everyone in New Hampshire was saying, like, when you left a store or you talked with a stranger, it was Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
And you're right. It feels weird.
I think the only thing is, I you know, like, the outrage over Merry Christmas, I don't think it exists.
No,
like, I really don't.
It really does. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are fucking small bullshit people that will be mad at anything, and that's one of the myriad of things that people are mad at. Like, if you can or cannot say Merry Christmas, it's the same type of people who just rage about free speech and don't realize what it actually means. Free speech is not a get out of jail free card for people being dipshits. It just means you won't go to jail.
Yeah.
It's fucking stupid, man. Anyway, I hope
breathe the eight this moment.
Yeah. fuck you. I hope that everyone, honestly, around this winter solstice got at least a little bit of time off and a break and got to see family and friends, because that's been really fun for me. And that's honestly what I think about when it comes to this time of the year. Not necessarily, like, I think about the white elephant party, and I think about seeing my folks, and that's cool.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. It's a nice time of year, and you know, hopefully everyone is having a little bit of a break.
Yeah.
Jacob emailed us in at onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com with an email title. You both got me thinking about authenticity. It's been a while since a cinematic semantic rift came between both your minds, so it was honestly kind of lovely to hear you navigate that on the Pinocchio episode. And this is true. I've noticed we don't argue as much anymore, and that was one where we had a polite disagreement about whether a film that sit in a country mm-hmm. played in its original language would be more effective
yeah.
or not.
Yep.
And so Jacob writes in, my thoughts. A movie set in Italy that is created with Italian actors in the Italian language will undoubtedly be more authentic than the same movie done in the English language. However, I think I am firmly in Matt's camp that more authenticity doesn't result in an undoubtedly richer, better, whatever positive adjective you want to put in here, experience for a particular watcher. I think a hypothetical might help illustrate why I feel this way. If someone made an Italian movie but had the actors delivering the lines that were nonsensical or even just somewhat off, but performed it in a way so that they lined up with the English subtitles then and what was being captured on camera, I believe I would be none the wiser. I would come out of that experience thinking that what I saw was an authentic and moving, but I would have been duped. And if I can be duped, it makes a question what where your feeling of authenticity makes the movie better for me comes from. And I think it comes from wanting the beauty of the entire world to be expressed in all its possible variations by all its varied and beautiful people. But I think I also need to understand that my feeling of authenticity is honestly a bit shallow, probably a bit stereotypical, non-deep representations I've assimilated all my life. I think, though, there's something else to draw from this. Even if in individual cases, for individual watchers, the impact beauty of the other cultures might come through better or in a less authentic form, the goal of allowing or showcasing the nuances of the beauty of the world is just more important. And with that goal in mind, maybe Pinocchio would have been better in Italian. Oh, taking two sides of the coin there.
Jacob, write a video essay.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a really good breakdown.
Yeah.
No notes? I don't
know. No, I think maybe I could have qualified my statements about being effective better with the follow up of all things considered or all things being equal. So saying that Pinocchio, for example, was directed exactly the same way with the exact same effort and care put into the characterizations of character, the same sort of storytelling beats, exactly that. But I still firmly believe that had it been in the Italian language, there would have been an added layer to it, which for me would have, perhaps authenticity is the right word, made it more effective. But that's not to say that it wasn't effective right. in the form that it was in.
And I think to Jacob's point, he covered a lot of ground there, and you read it very quickly. I'm going to have to listen to that at half speed. But and I'm trying to remember if I made this point, but I was thinking about it. Mm. Authenticity and better, like, let's call it effectiveness.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think is a straight correlation because of who people are.
Right.
And so while something could be more authentic, it could be less effective. Something could be less authentic and be more effective. It depends on the person who is being affected.
And I'll just caveat that by thinking of it this way then, because we're sort of speaking about hypothetical viewers. So for the hypothetical Italian viewer, watching a film that is set in their culture, in mm-hmm. their country, mm-hmm. in their town, about their history, but being spoken in not in their language, would inevitably be a less authentic
yes.
and less effective experience than had it been in their language.
Whereas,
right?
yes, 1,000%. Whereas yeah. all of that, what you said to, let's say, an English-speaking audience, is technically less authentic, but more effective in what
we don't
the
know
movie
if
is.
It's more effective because the effectiveness doesn't have to do with the language. It has to do with
I would, and then this is I'm globalizing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
this is not absolute. Yeah. I would still posit it would be more effective because they are hearing it in a language that they understand. And therefore, on the surface, I would say it is more effective overall than, and also this depends, I'm saying this in sort of a, like, for humans who are used to watching films with audio in a language that they can hear and understand. Everyone is different.
Yeah.
Like, there are edge cases, and or not even edge cases, just like the different people and the way things, but I'm talking about, like,
yeah.
if I'm just going mass market, what people are selling us in the majority, I would say it would be more effective. But again,
but yeah, there's more to that as well.
Oh God, this is a complicated. Like, yeah, it's a non-glass onion. One
yeah.
might say.
We'll just keep peeling it back until we get to nothing.
And then Shahir, could you? Oh, thank you, Jacob. By the way, Shahir, could you please read the second one? Because since we're in person, I don't have a screen in front of me.
Yeah.
I've scratched all my notes down, and you have a laptop.
That's true. Muhammad writes, "Hi guys, and happy holidays to you. So I just finished listening to your Joker episode, and I have a few things to unload off my chest."
Wow, the Joker episode?
I believe Muhammad's going through the episodes one by one.
First of all, amazing. Second of all, I remember nothing of what I said. So let's
yeah,
let's
you know, it's yeah, going. That's a good point. Muhammad says, I don't hate movies. Sure, there are films that are not my cup of tea or the subject matter didn't appeal to me, but I don't go out of my way to shit on movies because a lot of talented people do hard work to bring them to life. But honestly, fuck Joker. Yeah. Fuck this film 1,000 times.
Yes, yes, yes.
Joker does the... I got to remember this movie a little bit more. Joker does the grave scene of explaining his origins, which in my opinion is one of his greatest strengths, but it also turns him into a sort of hero for the poor people of Gotham City and turns the Wayne family into a typical oblivious upper-class representative, with which I have some issues with because in Batman lore, the Wayne family have always been a properly philanthropic family. Joker could have been a proper and nuanced exploration of mental health and its failures, but instead what we got is the Killing Joke light, which again, I don't understand why he's so revered so much, since Moore himself has distanced away from it and considers it his least favorite work. Anyway, this film has cursed me because I got into a fender bender right after coming out of the theater seeing it. I hate this goddamn film from the bottom of my heart. Wishing you a happy and healthy new year, and I can't wait to hear your thoughts on Ghost in the Shell. Thank you, Muhammad. We will do Ghost in the Shell at some point.
So I don't remember exactly what I said on Joker. I do remember really disliking Joker.
Hmm. I have a thing, which is that if a movie I've disliked and also said that I didn't like on the podcast, I will think back on it more favorably because I always think then that I've got to give that movie a second chance. Because I'm always worried that I've like been too harsh on something. In my memory, I think my theory of the Joker or my thinking about the Joker was that I admired it, in terms of like trying to do, you know, like we're in a saturated market of superhero, you know, comic book movies. This is a movie that is taking, you know, trying to do the origin story of a villain and also trying to rewrite that origin story in sort of an interesting way. You know, remember when we talked about Batman, The Mask of the Phantasm, we were kind of like both chuffed with the idea that they took, they whole cloth reinvented something about, Batman. And from memory, I think it, what didn't work about the Joker was this idea that his actions become, you know, he becomes a pariah for impoverished people of Gotham City. And I think, and from memory, it felt a little clunky in that respect. I mean, the dude goes on TV and murders someone straight up on television and somehow becomes a hero. But I think, you know, it's also one of those things that, you know, a movie like Glass Onion is a really great example of, is that the more you watch a film, the more you see both the intent and structure revealing itself. And sometimes things reveal itself in interesting ways that you might not have expected. That's to say, when I watched the Joker, you know, when I watched Joker for the first time, I was not, you know, as enamored by it by everyone else. But I admired the swing from memory.
I don't have a problem with changing the Waynes or the Joker. I mean, again, I think the thing that makes Joker interesting is intrinsically not his origin story.
Right.
I think the fact that he has 1,000 of them and no one knows what the real one is. Like, I know now it's kind of, there's certain canons and things that sort of change that, but the idea behind the Joker was no one really knows where the Joker came from.
I mean, that's been one or two versions of the story. Yeah, it's not like...
Well, the reason why I think it's the one that sticks, especially for me...
Yeah.
Is it, that's a very comic booky thing. Right. Like the Joker could have all or none of every origin story that has been written or performed by him. Right. Yeah. Like that's just how it could be. I like that.
Yeah.
I also don't mind if the Waynes are taken down a peg or two, because as we've seen, you know, throughout history, the idea of a philanthropic billionaire legacy family that is all good is probably not the best thing to permeate. It could be a story, but sure.
That's also what the new Batman film, the Matt Reeves Batman film, does.
Oh, well. I know. I'm just saying. But then you look at too what Batman is. And yeah, could Batman actually help more by spending his money and like redoing the government and sort of taking over it? Sure, but then he doesn't get to punch clowns in the face.
Right.
So I get the exercise.
Yeah.
The thing I didn't like about Joker is it felt like to me, and again, oh God, it's been so long and I'll have to revisit it. And I will still say this unabashedly because I remember how passionately when I used to think about it, I hated it.
Yeah.
It was a movie dealing with a lot of intelligent subject matters incredibly stupidly. I think it knocks a ton of complexities down to the lowest common denominator and actually misses the mark when it does it, when it like switches the game to easy mode and still misses.
Right.
I get annoyed. I am curious about what this second one with like Lady Gaga that like might be a musical kind of is.
I think it is a musical, right? Yeah.
Like that seems like a fun swing to me. Like yeah. I honestly think that's the only thing that would get me back on board.
Yeah.
It's funny. I never thought I'd be curious about a Joker sequel, and that I am now. So, right.
Yeah, because we don't know what direction we'll go in, and I think that's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Again, thank you, Muhammad, for that email. Thanks to everyone who emails us in, onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Hey, you can email us in. Yes, you, listener right now, walking down the street or in your home. Ooh, you know what I want to know when you write us in? I want to know where you are when you listen to us, not like the actual location. Don't send me GPS coordinates or some shit. I'm talking about like cooking dinner, walking
the toilet.
On the toilet. No, like I'm just curious because like, okay, so my podcast listening has changed in the pandemic, I would obviously say.
Yeah.
I put podcasts on when I have, because I don't go out as much anymore. I don't commute as much. If I'm on the subway, I listen to a podcast.
Yeah.
But now, since that's so little, I end up, whenever I'm having to do, I'll say, any multiple room activity in my apartment,
yeah,
I put it on.
Right.
Either in headphones or in a speaker that I can hear everything. And that's when I listen. But I'll never listen to a podcast in one room.
Okay.
Like, I'll throw on a video essay, or I'll throw on something if I'm in the office. I'll throw on Critical Role if I'm painting minis in the kitchen. Like, podcasts specifically are multi-room affairs. I need to be traveling.
You need to, yeah, okay, so that's...
Cars, if I'm ever in, when we were driving home, we listened to a podcast.
What, we need to get to Glass Onion, but what podcast did you listen to?
Oh, God, it was one that Jamie pulled up. It was a new one, and I liked it. It was a health and wellness podcast about the misguidedness of, like,
kombucha?
Yeah, kombucha. No, it was, I don't remember the name of the podcast, but it was about the idea of wellness and companies, like corporate wellness programs, and how they were invented, why they were invented, and how they're utterly failures, not only for people that don't fit a certain norm, but also for the people that fit the norm. They actually, the idea used to be like, oh, well, with health insurance, like if you have a company wellness program, like if you spend $1, you'll save $3. And all of that data is bullshit and made up.
Right.
And like, and it's just, it was a really interesting thing. If you search wellness programs for podcasts, I'm sure you'll find it. I'll probably think of it like 90% way through this pod for this through this podcast.
All right, I'm Googling that right now, but I'm curious where we go to.
Sorry, fun podcast. I can't remember your name. I'll shout it out next week. I'll get it from.
That's why they got to have a great title where they're going. What was that podcast about movies? It was the only one I listened
There's an asterisk.
Yeah, I don't know what it was, but the hosts were assholes and didn't get to the movie till 30 minutes in.
That's our shtick.
Yeah, that's what we do.
Yeah,
I am excited to be revisiting, well, not revisiting, but I guess getting a sort of quasi-unofficial, sequel.
Returning to.
Benoit Blanc has returned in the much-anticipated sequel to Knives Out, which, of course, was a great success for Rian Johnson. I recall when we talked about Rian Johnson, we did The Last Jedi and then we did Knives Out. I think those are the only two Rian Johnson movies we've done on this show, right? We didn't do Looper.
That was before our time.
Before our time, but an excellent film. I'm a big fan of Rian Johnson, having seen Brick in a movie theater before, you know, like at the time it was released. And I think we had a conversation when we were doing The Last Jedi where I said something to the effect of, look, I really like Rian Johnson. I think he's really good at what he does here. And I think The Last Jedi, you know, is a really good testament to what he does. I'm not particularly interested in The Last Jedi. I'm not particularly interested in Star Wars anymore. And I would love the idea that Rian Johnson, this guy who's a really great writer, really inventive, really fun, you know, really well-versed filmmaker, would have something that was entirely his own. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, a few years later, I was very chuffed when I heard this. Netflix decided to pay $400 million for the sequels to Knives Out, or to own the Knives Out franchise, and essentially gave Rian Johnson carte blanche to continue making these films.
But now they own it.
But of course they own it.
Yeah.
But he actually in an interview recently talked about the fact that he will get no royalties from this. He has been paid out in full He will be paid to make the movies, but it's not like George Lucas with Star Wars kind of thing. It'll be more, he's more than comfortable with what he's been made. Of course, Knives Out is not a merchandising mecca, probably, no. You know, unless people are buying Benoit Blanc pajamas, which I would happily throw down some cash for. So
swimming shirts?
Yeah, swimming shirts. I would, what is the, whatever it's called that Benoit Blanc wears around?
A neckerchief.
A neckerchief.
Yeah.
But I'm more than excited about the fact that Rian Johnson basically is crafting his own modern cinematic universe, much akin to the film that got released just last week, James Cameron's Avatar, just in a very different way. Now, before we get to that, I also want to stress this is one of the most unusual business case examples. We talked about this previously as well, which is that Netflix has paid $400 million or maybe $450. I'm not sure. They paid that
a lot of money.
Yeah. Plus then the actual they actually paid the production budget as well, which is only $40 million. Comparatively speaking, that's, you know, they paid 10 times the production value to own the rights to this. And Knives Out in its original form was a fairly big hit given what it was, given the marketplace that we exist in. I mentioned the superhero thing already. Superhero blockbusters, you know, like the kind of action spectaculars. So it was unusual for a film like Knives Out to do as well as it did. Netflix released this, or essentially kind of four-walled this in cinemas around America for only 1 week in Thanksgiving. And it was a big coup for Netflix because they also got Cinemark, Regal, and AMC involved in that, which they hadn't previously done before. They had their own theater, which they will four-wall things in. But this is one a case where they, you know, put it into every theater, but only for a week.
I wish I had seen it
then. Yeah.
That would have been really fun.
But the interesting thing there is that it kind of, that action into itself, you know, it's very hard. Variety has a great article where they basically are saying, we're trying to figure out what the strategy is here. But you know, this is all speculation. We obviously don't have like real analytic insights onto what Netflix is thinking or how they're going to operate this. But my feeling is that their gambit is that while other studios like Disney will be the home of Marvel and Star Wars, Netflix will only be the home, will be the only home of things like, of something like Knives Out. And I also think that For them, that means these are not, unlike the Marvel, Star Wars, Avatar, what have you, these are not movies to play in a cinema. These are movies to play at home. And I think that is part of Netflix's business model. You know, for years they've been trying to chase the sort of prestige film that does have that theatrical experience sort of attached to it in some way, you know, things like The Irishman and Roma. But I think now we're starting to see like, hey, what are movies that we can do that are uniquely ours that does benefit, not necessarily benefit, but plays only for the home experience.
Well, so there's something interesting to that, right? I do think they were chasing prestige, and I think that was the wrong move.
Why was that the wrong move?
I mean, did it help them?
Well, if they'd won,
they didn't. So yeah. It was the wrong move. I'm not saying it's a hindsight call. I'm just saying it wasn't the right move. We see that now. The thing with Knives Out in particular and like buying that property, it's like it wants to be its own thing, but its own thing is buying other things, and that's always kind of been the thing that makes Netflix good, is them buying other people's thing. like there's been some Netflix, it's funny, I never know what, when they're like, ooh, a Netflix original thing, right? Like that could mean a trillion things at this point. It could mean that like Netflix and their studios like made it, or it could mean they just bought it.
Right. But the other studios do that.
Like, I know, but like Disney, the, you know, my point is, let me I'll back up. Over the last, I'd say, 2 years, the majority of Netflix content that they'll say is original or produced by Netflix has started to look the same. The color palette, the lighting, like a ton of stuff just feels kind of homogenous. And I'm starting to notice it more and more, and I'm getting more and more sick of it. Glass Onion kind of breaks that mold. There's a little bit of like you can see the Netflix on it a little bit, but it does a lot of great other heavy lifting elsewhere, where I think like the cheaper edges are sanded off. I think that Netflix will become the home for the, this is a weird thing to say, especially after they just bought a franchise, but kind of the home of non-traditionally franchisable films. And that might mean, what I'd love to see that mean is a return to the mid-level movie.
Right. Which this is. $40 million.
Yeah. Which I really, really, we don't have a place for that. Apparently, the way that the movie-going experience, it's either giant blockbuster or indie to go to a cinema. Right. So, like, if the if mid-level movies are going to exist, this might be a place where that happens. Or it's just going to... I don't know. I'm curious what's going to happen with Netflix on the other side of the spectrum, which is the killing password sharing.
Okay.
And what that's going to do to their business model. I think it's going to help. I think they think it's going to help them. I think in the long term, it's going to hurt them. But again, we'll see.
Yeah.
Netflix has made some incredibly intelligent decisions. And in the past, it's so funny how we quickly forget these things. It's also made some incredibly boneheaded decisions and almost like folded like three times. So
this was the Quickster debacle.
Yeah. So like, I don't know. I like Netflix. I like that Netflix is a thing. One thing I don't like with all of the streaming services, I know we're kind of going all over the place though, is the idea was we get to have a catalog of all the things available to us at all times. And I think every streaming service, Netflix included, is realizing that they can't actually do that because their new stuff will be buried by their old stuff if their old stuff is good enough. And now they're taking things off their services and even original things. And that sucks.
So you're talking about the HBO Westworld decision.
That's one of the elements of this. But also, right. Like, I love, case in point, I love the Castlevania anime that Netflix produced.
Yeah.
Or bought, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I was like, they're gonna remove that someday. Like, I know they are. Like, if they're licensing it from Konami, there'll be a thing or like whatever, and it's gonna go away.
Right.
And I was like, that was one of the only things I asked for in physical media for Christmas this year was all four seasons of Castlevania. Because right. I'm like, this feels like a thing that's going to disappear, and I love it very much.
So you're buying it out of scarcity.
Of perceived scarcity. Whether or not I am correct, time will tell.
Yeah.
But my point is, like, will we get a Blu-ray release of Glass Onion?
Potentially. I don't know. Does it matter?
Like, it does matter. It matters to me because I am a proponent of physical media. I was talking to Dave Wiskus of Nebula yesterday. We were hanging out and he got a PS5 and we were talking about the pros and the only one available was the one with the disc drive.
Yep. Which I have.
And he's like, I really don't want it. I don't buy anything.
Yeah.
Like it's like an extra $100 or whatever it is. And like, it's just stupid. It's perfunctory.
Yeah.
And then it just got us sort of starting to talk about like how we interact with media, and everyone's different and there's no right or wrong thing. I just, when there's a piece, let's even pare it down to, and I think it only kind of works really with film now because games get updated and have online components and they'll never be forever like they kind of used to be overall. Films are different. Films, I mean, we've seen them get edited again and change, of course, post-release, but overall I like the idea that once a film is in a theater, it's done.
Right.
And I want to, if I love that film,
yeah,
I don't want to rely on a third party to be able to feed it to me. Like, and again, I understand that I have to go to a manufacturer and buy a Blu-ray player and a television, and there's other outside factors. I'm talking about like the actual media itself. I don't want it to be served to me consistently like a meal I have to order out again and again and again. I want to be able to do it at home. I want to be able to have it.
Yeah.
And I do worry that a lot of these great things that I really, truly love on streaming services are going to not – they're just going to go away.
Yeah.
Because there'll be a tax write-off or a thing, or the licenses will run out, and then we won't have them. And that sucks. The flip side of that argument, if I want to argue with myself, is that there's too much media and we're never going to have time to watch or let alone rewatch everything anyway. And sure, whatever, like, let's live in the moment. But I don't really pertain to that. And on the flip side.
Yeah.
I just realized something while having this conversation.
Okay.
I, up to this point, have bought every Marvel film.
Yeah.
On Blu-ray. I was proud of this collection.
Yeah.
And with Doctor Strange and Thor Love and Thunder, we were in a Best Buy yesterday and I saw Thor Love and Thunder on the Blu-ray on the shelf. And rather than have any like, ooh, I should continue my collection, I actively thought in my head, yuck.
I don't want this.
And I was like, oh my God, I'm free. I don't have to buy every one of these.
Yeah.
The streak is broken.
Yeah.
And in part, honestly, the thing that got me free of that was that Disney Plus exists.
Right.
If I ever want, mm-hmm. on an off chance,
yeah.
to watch a worse film than Thor Ragnarok, I can go watch Thor Love and Thunder on a streaming service that I have. So it goes, I mean, what mm-hmm. do you, I know you like physical media. You like the Criterion Collection.
Yeah.
But there's also a streaming service for that now. Like,
there is a streaming service. And for example, Roma, which is a Netflix film, is released on the Criterion Collection, and I own that. On the Criterion Collection disc. I think the emphasis is perhaps not misguided, but like...
How dare you?
How dare I? It's just that I'm not worried about people not being able to watch Thor Love and Thunder in any format or you know, Castlevania or whatever. There are certain movies that the issue is that there are certain movies that have made no money, that don't meet the financial requirements of existing on a streaming service or on physical media, that will get lost over time.
I think Thor Love and Thunder is an example exactly of the opposite of what you're saying. I think Castlevania is actually closer to what you're describing, just a different interest point for you.
But, you know, so I think those are interesting cases where movies will be lost forever. It's also like, why do we curate? Like, I don't think I curate to discover. I curate to preserve. Right?
Same.
Like,
same. Yeah, oh, yeah.
You know, so I'm not, I don't buy movies that I haven't seen before on a Blu-ray.
Same.
I buy things that I've seen before many times and I think I'll want to revisit.
The only Blu-ray I can think of that I bought before watching it was Escape Room Tournament of Champions.
I thought you had watched that. Escape
Room. No.
Escape.
The sequel. To Escape Room. I bought on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
I was like, you got me, Escape Room.
But did you buy it because it was like cheaper than going to the movie theater?
No, I missed it in the movie theater. Yeah. And then when it came out on Blu-ray, I was like, I'm going to want this.
Okay. All right.
That's the one I could think of. Email us in, onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. Do you ever buy physical media of a film before you've watched it?
At any rate, I think there is something to Netflix's strategy. I think, you know, obviously the media landscape is changing. The interesting thing that's happening this year is there, you know, there are big heavy hitter films that are coming out. Like, for example, Bardo, the Alejandro Iñárritu film, mm-hmm. is available on Netflix streaming right now. But we're, you know, it's not high on either of our lists to talk about. What else has come out recently that, I feel like this is the first year in a while where I'm not on top of the big name movies. And when I say big name movies, in terms of the movies that I think are going to be significantly remembered in years to come, you know, I try to make an estimation about that. And I think what's happened is there are a bunch of movies, you know, The Fablemans has not made a dent. On pop culture, despite being one of the highest reviewed films of the year. You know, Bardo, I think, which did really well at I believe Cannes, is not a movie that's, you know, like it's on Netflix right now. Most people wouldn't even know it exists out there. There are lots of movies that are coming out that like people aren't going to see or acknowledge. You know, Damien Chazelle's Babylon is a 3-hour release, and it's like, you know, like what's the push for us to go see that? You know, he just a few years ago, him doing First Man was a huge deal. La La Land was one of the biggest things that, you know, could exist. There's so much saturation now. And I think what's happening is, in previous years, there was like a real push towards the blockbuster or towards the indie this time of the year, or towards, you know, certain movies that we kind of felt were going to hit towards the Oscars. And this year we don't really know which direction anything is going in. And, you know, I think it's great that a film like Glass Onion is really, I actually think it's a really good calculation on Netflix's part.
Yes.
To say December 23rd, Glass Onion, you're at home, it's Christmas with your family. This is a movie that grownups can put on after the kids go to bed.
It's also a movie that wide age ranges of adults will enjoy.
Teenagers, adults, and you know, like your elderly adults, everyone's going to enjoy this movie. And I think it's a smart gambit.
It was really, really good. Yeah.
You watched it with my family. I watched it with my wife, and we had two guests over, and it was like, I was always concerned that, you know, this is kind of, I said to everyone, hey, I need to watch this for the podcast. And, you know, when you got friends over, it's like, everyone talks to the movie, not a soul, not a peep. Everyone was watching.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's because if we put on a Marvel movie, for example, everyone would be talking throughout the whole thing. You know, I mean, we watched movies the night before and the night after, and everyone was chit-chatting through all of those stuff, even things we hadn't seen before. But this, everyone was quiet. Everyone sat down. Everyone watched. Everyone wanted to watch.
It's a perfect confluence of timing, of knowing where your audience is, of knowing what kind of story will permeate for the largest user demographic. Honestly, murder mysteries and fun murder mysteries, I feel like, is a genre that will pull in the widest berth of folks.
Yeah.
And
true crimes on podcast, you know, is like one of the biggest genres.
Exactly.
But to that note as well, you know, there was a remake an update of Fletch this year with John Hamm, Confess Fletch, which is a murder mystery, which apparently is terrific. And, you know, it's on HBO, I think, right now. Or
it's funny. Dave was telling me how much fun he had watching that, too.
Yeah.
So
See How They Run, which has got Sam Rockwell and Saoirse Ronan in it, is on HBO as well. Another great murder mystery. I think everyone's, you know, for whatever we think about Netflix's business model, I think they're... they have to differentiate themselves from Marvel, from Disney, and I think this was a smart play.
And Knives Out is an interesting thing because it was not a thing, and then culturally it became a thing.
Right.
This wasn't even like Netflix has sort of, I mean, and the closest thing I could think of on Netflix's camp of not being a thing and becoming a thing is Stranger Things. like Stranger Things
is a lot of things.
I know is a fucking institution now, and it was not that.
Yeah.
And currently, I know Netflix's big television hit is Wednesday, but that actually, Wednesday's fine. Like, I've been watching it.
Yeah.
It's fine. Selena Gomez? No.
I don't know her name.
The lead actress is killing it on that thing. But the reason that is blowing up is because of the dance scene in TikTok. Like, that's the reason that is, like, it's a good show that is elevated through social media and things like that.
My wife watched it, though, and she, you know, it's funny. My wife watched it, and she didn't realize that the dance sequence had become viral. She said, she was like, I really like the show. It's really fun. The lead actress is really great.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is Zoe Dutch? I don't know. Whatever. Apologies. But then I showed her that the dance sequence had gone viral, and she was like, oh yeah, this is really cool. It's cool that it's gotten picked up.
Everyone comes at it from different things. I think the cool thing about Knives Out is it became, from being nothing, a household name.
Started from the bottom, now we're here.
But that's like Wednesday Addams. People still in passing know the Addams family.
Yeah.
Like Knives Out, Benoit Blanc was nobody until Knives Out was honestly a banger success.
Yeah.
And now with a second one, it's sort of solidified. It got me thinking about the start of, I don't want to say legends. That sounds too fucking pompous. Like of long-term characters.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know where this is going to go. Maybe it stops after three movies. Who the hell knows? But is Benoit Blanc going to be another Sherlock Holmes, James Bond, Batman? Like character that, like, someone else might continue to play. But honestly, and again, I don't know. Maybe. But before Knives Out, I can't think of a property whose main character was designed in my lifetime, was conceived of, that has like potential to continue on.
I mean, yeah, but I think the thing is that,
because there's a lot of characters.
There's a lot of characters, but also, like, this is how Bond with Ian Fleming started. This is how Hercule Poirot.
What I'm saying,
and you know, when I said I want Rian Johnson to create his own thing.
Yeah.
It's great that he's created his own thing.
Yeah. But my point is, the media landscape is so different from when Bond when Batman or when everything was developed.
Yeah.
I think it's much harder. I think because we don't see them permeate through and have staying power.
Yeah.
I can't think of another character that really that has the possibility of living on in a franchise past the actor.
Yeah.
Like, look, you could go, like, everyone I can think of is still so closely tied to the actor, like Dominic Toretto.
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to remake Fast and the Furious without Vin Diesel being someone being dumb. And if they do, I think it would probably flop.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, like just things like, I don't know, characters living.
Yeah.
And Daniel Craig is amazing at it, and he's what helps pull it off and whatever, but like Knives Out could be another thing if they play their cards right and keep doing wonderful stuff with it.
All right, we should get to the movie, but
just... Oh, fuck! you want me to read what it's about?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I wrote it down with on
sorry,
paper.
You just had like an oh fuck that was like out of nowhere there, and I was like, did you hurt yourself just then?
No. That was you like, we should move on. And I was like, I was referencing oh fuck as in like, oh, it's been 35 minutes and we haven't talked about the movie. But in case you're wondering what IMDb says that Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery is about, they say that famed Southern detective Benoit Blanc travels to Greece for his latest case.
Easy. It's just easy. Yeah.
It's so perfect.
It's Benoit Blanc in Greece with a murder mystery. What do you want, guys?
Yeah.
Take your slop and eat it. I loved this film. I loved it in that it tickled the... It was a perfect night in for me. It was like, I'm here, my wife, and my friends, and we all enjoy, like, and we all watched a movie together. I don't think any of us have the attention span to watch a movie together that we haven't seen before, that we can't, you know, like, you know, when you're around with people, and this was just like such a great, and it was, I love that it was like a grown-up movie. Mm-hmm. It was silly. Don't get me wrong. It's silly and buffoonish and kind of childish at times.
By the end, it kind of becomes a cartoon.
Yeah. It's got this cartoonish vibe to it. But at the same time, I wasn't watching people in spandex like in superheroes beat up things. I was watching people talk about ideas and like have ideas change on themselves in sort of fun ways. It's a fun, silly romp that's really, really pleasurable to watch.
It proves something that I love to see. This isn't the first time it's been proved. It's just something every time I witness it, I am in awe and I love experiencing. Silliness does not have to be stupid.
Yeah, at all.
And this movie is so like rich in things to mine from it if you want to.
Yeah.
Or you could let it wash over you and like there's different
and
ways
have a great
to
time.
Experience this. Yeah. I want to watch this again. I'm probably gonna rewatch it this week at some point.
Yeah.
Because I've just heard from everyone like, oh, it's great first viewing, but like second viewing is like where it's at.
Well, it's, you know, like when Yo-Yo Ma appears in the Jennifer Hudson scene and talks about the idea that there's a piece of music which, when played over itself, reveals additional complexity. And then the film essentially halfway through plays back on itself and reveals additional complexity. I was like, yeah.
This movie,
Rian Johnson, man,
is a masterclass in self-referencing things that you don't know are important that are the entirety of what everything else is talking about.
Yeah.
Like, it's funny. We can talk. We'll debate this as we go on discussing it. Like, I'm going to say this. If you're listening to this podcast and it's 40 minutes in or whatever we're at right now, I need you to have watched A Glass Onion before we continue.
Of course.
It's even less about spoilers and more about connective tissue.
Yeah.
Because there's too many fun things to discuss.
Yeah.
That I'm hoping that some of the things that maybe Shahir and I noticed are things that maybe you didn't and you're like, oh fuck, like that'd be really fun. Or you can email us in with your things you found at onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Well, we should talk about like what Knives Out, essentially at the heart of Knives Out, if we were talking about it as a franchise.
The center of the glass onion.
Well, Knives Out as a franchise itself between this movie and the first movie is a critique on both wealth and capitalism. But different kinds of wealth and capitalism. And I think maybe if that's going to be the heart of what Knives Out is going forward, I think that's a really interesting place to place it, because it's got so much room to maneuver here. Like in the first movie, it really was about generational wealth, right? Like it was really about
old money.
Yeah, old money and what happens when money gets passed down through the generations and like what happens to and how it affects the children who receive that money, because of how oblivious they become to the issues around them.
Eat shit.
Exactly. And in this case, this is about new money. This is about new, you know, newfound wealth by people who may have acquired the moniker of genius at some point, but really reveal themselves over time to have not necessarily earned that moniker.
Elon Musk, Elon Musk, Elon Musk, Elon Musk.
Ryan Johnson and Edward Norton have gone on the record and said, look, it is based on a lot of things, and like, you know, the movie was shot and written prior to this,
that makes it better.
Yeah, prior to the acquisition of Twitter. But it really, you know, I think maybe the sort of Trumpian vibe to it as well, like the new...
disruptors.
Disruptors.
When they drop that at first earnestly, and then they sort of as it goes, you figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
It's such a perfect fucking encapsulation of the brain rot and poison that anyone who considers themselves that is.
Yeah.
And all the different kinds.
It reminds, you know, what I think as a lazy viewer on Hustle Talk, you know, like there's this thing that's been talked about, which is Hustle Talk, which is hustle culture. You know, people who are like, you know, side hustling or talking about marketing points and all this, you know.
ABH?
ABH?
Always be hustling?
Always be hustling. Yeah, I guess so. Which is just a reiteration of Glenn Ross's Always Be Closing.
Here's the thing about hustle culture.
Yeah.
I know we're tangenting so hard, I don't even care.
No, but I think this is what the actual mystery of the movie is a fun reveal. It is really fun to watch. But where the movie works is that the substance of why its mystery exists, more, you know, like when Miles Braun kind of says, most importantly, you've got to figure out the why of whether, you know, this murder is happening, I think is really... open to mind. And like, there's a lot of reflection of where the culture is at this point. Now, it's going to be difficult, you know, as Ryan Johnson has, you know, worked, has made, you know, potentially hundreds of millions of dollars on this or millions of dollars on this to like maintain that air of, I've got my finger on the pulse of like authentic, human capital, or, you know, like the waves of human capital. But
I'm going to say this,
not to say that he's not incapable.
I'm going to say this.
Yeah.
The American dream is built on the idea that we are all displaced millionaires.
Right.
I don't have a problem with millionaires.
Right.
I have a problem with billionaires. And I'm not going to put Ryan Johnson's wealth about making a film about these things in the same level as either of the families or people who are we are talking about in these films. They are critiquing a billionaire class, which is much different, I think, than a millionaire class.
I'm sure. I'm not in no way suggesting that Ryan Johnson is incapable of making those observations. I think part of what Ryan Johnson says, though, in both Knives Out and Glass Onion, is that once you've attained a certain level of wealth, your ability to observe those who don't have it becomes diminished in some way.
A million percent. Yeah. And, I mean, look, I think mine's the milk test.
Okay. Yeah. If, what is it? How much is a?
If you can't tell me what an average cost of a half gallon of milk is, then you're out of touch.
I can't tell you how much the average cost of a half gallon of milk is. I think it's $5.
Well, no. In the city, a half gallon is roughly $3.50.
$3.50. Okay.
I buy
the big gallon.
Oh, so you're probably closer to $5.
Yeah, yeah.
In New Hampshire,
and I still don't know the metric system yet.
In New Hampshire, I looked at it. It was $1.67, roughly.
There you go.
Or $1.69, nothing 67. What am I saying? But my point is. but like, if you had come back and been like, what is it, like $10?
It's like $10.
Like that would be like. Like but the truth and I think there's while Knives Out one Knives Out was about I think the damage that it causes a family and the honestly like you put it I thought it was very apt like the children of generational wealth that is a poison on society in general. And
it can be, I think, maybe the way.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Always edge cases, always different things. Rules are made to be broken. But I would say, I feel confident saying this, generational wealth and the children of billionaires have caused more problems than good. And look, you don't have to agree. I'm making a global wide statement I cannot back up. That's what it feels like to me. Whereas this film... is dealing with sort of the like you said, sort of hustle culture push forward. And the idea, the thing that gets me about hustle culture, and I love that we're coming back to this 10 minutes later, I always question, what's the point? What's the point of hustle? Shear, if I was to ask you, what do you think the point of hustle culture is? Do you have an idea or an answer to that?
No, I don't have a clear answer to that. I think what it is there's a self-permutation, as you mentioned, of Americans or American culture that believes that both simultaneously we are displaced millionaires, and if we have not attained millionaire status or whatever status that we're trying to acquire, we are also inherently lazy. And you know, like, and I think that has affected us in some way where we think, you know, like, we don't live in a sort of post-agricultural society where you can get one job, work your whole life, and be able to afford a house anymore. We live in a society where to be able to afford, like, what was normal economic values, like houses and that sort of thing, you need to do something extraordinary.
Yep.
And I think that has created this sort of strange rift. Again, I mentioned this book, I think it was by David P. Schlipper, The Working Poor, when we discussed Emily the Criminal, not Emily in Paris.
Ooh.
Emily in Paris.
Different franchise.
It would be amazing if Emily in Paris was the sequel to Emily the Criminal.
Ooh. Or if there was a crossover event.
Yeah, exactly. I think that that's what it gets to. And then again, at the heart of Glass Onion, the movie we're actually here to talk about, is this idea that there is this character who has achieved who has achieved enormous wealth, but that enormous wealth, you know, kind of in almost the Ayn Rand kind of way, given them this sense that they are, that they have a particular hold on how the world can be shaped, you know, like, and their philosophy of life can affect the way people can think. So, you know, this idea of disruption, you know, breaking the system is like more prevalent than, hey, you just invented this cool thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's when you start self-aggrandizing to the point where it is not going to be sustainable in the long run. I mean, yeah. Again, to Miles's character, the ties to sort of an Elon Musk-esque person is just undeniable.
Yeah.
There was a really great tweet recently where it's like...
owned by Elon Musk.
Yeah, I know, right? Where it was like when he said was an expert on electric cars and it was getting profitable, I took him for his word because I don't know anything about electric cars. It's a small industry. When he said he was an expert on rocket science, I don't make rockets, and that's a small industry, and I took him for his word because that seemed to be working out. When he starts talking about software, and I realize how full of shit he is, because not only do I know a lot about software, but tons of other people. So the job market is huge.
Yeah.
Then it's like, well, maybe he didn't really know about electric cars and rockets. And so, like, it's this idea of these groups these people that we've sort of built up to be a certain thing that there's no possible way that it's the great man. That doesn't exist. A great man in history or in current day pop culture can't exist because there's too much information. Yeah. Like you'll have sycophants and you'll have people that will defend that, but like, I'm sure in this world, there are people that love Miles and hate Miles.
Yeah.
And in what he invented, what Alpha was, a social media thing, no, or Alpha was a what?
I'm not actually sure what Alpha was, but
yeah, I think it was kind of like a Google,
yeah,
or something, perhaps, along those lines. And then in the film, his next big push is a is a hydrogen-based fuel source.
Yeah, the Hindenburg didn't exist.
And the cool thing about this movie is the foil to Benoit Blanc's genius is how stupid the mystery is.
Right.
And it ties back into the name of the film, Glass Onion, and what it is. It's an onion in narrative, and I think Shrek taught us this very well, is something that is complex, and you peel back the layers, and you're able to see a new element each time you peel back a layer. Mm. Whereas a glass onion, you can see right through to the center, and you don't really need to peel anything back. The Beatles song at the end of the movie, which is the song that kind of like just answered all the dumb Beatles mysteries.
Yeah.
Like, it is. It's a perfect ending and a perfect sort of. I think I read somewhere that Rian Johnson basically he didn't want to do an after credit scene, and he just wanted to play that song because he's like, this song is the after credit scene,
right?
Like, it's perfect.
Yeah.
So It's just, and it's a real, this whole movie is a real Emperor Has No Clothes kind of vibe to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great to see, something I particularly liked about it was sort of all the side characters, whether you had Dave Bautista or Kate Hudson or...
they're not really side characters, they're kind of main players, characters, right?
Sorry, yeah. Let me rephrase.
Yeah.
Side characters is the wrong word. Enablers.
Mm, yeah.
Enablers that are benefited by the type of person that Miles is.
Yeah.
And you see it permeated through a whole bunch of stuff. Like, it's just, it's interesting when you look at sort of like supporters of people like Trump or Elon or any of that stuff.
Mm.
Like these sort of like second tier players that are famous and rich.
Yeah.
But not as famous and rich as the other. And all they're doing is like chasing that like clout.
Or you know, like, you know, again, benefiting from the sustained order that is created by one person, you know, mm-hmm. breaking through in that way.
I love so much about this movie. I love the subtle hints about Miles and who he is and how he actually knows nothing of what he's talking about. I love that. There was a lot of conversation. I'm going to get into like late game spoilers here, and we can kind of go back and forth.
Yeah.
Miles in the film rents the fucking Mona Lisa due to the pandemic. He rents it for his party.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate bullshit billionaire thing to do.
Mm.
And it's also the only thing that could ruin him.
Yeah.
And it's also telegraphed with lines throughout the movie that it will be ruined and it will be the kill. Like, this is a movie that tells you exactly what it's going to do in such entertaining ways that, like, part of your brain realizes that you're being told the ending and part of it doesn't care because you're having so much fun and you're still like, there's a twist maybe here, there, or the other place. Like, I can't think of many movie franchises that really, truly do this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love the exercise of that balance.
Yeah.
It feels just fucking fun. And I've had long discussions about the end of the movie and like, Helen's character, who is played by Janelle Monáe.
Yeah, Andy.
It's Andy / Helen, twin sister, Andy's dead, yada, yada, yada. But then there's like, God, now I'm going to go on things. That's even callback to Grecian myth. Or Grecian legend, because Andy is short for Cassandra, mm-hmm. who is a prophet, but no one believes. So that's what Andy was doing with the power source. Yada yada yada. Helena is her sister. Mm-hmm. Hell, even Andy, when they think she's Andy, is drinking out of a Giannis mug, mm-hmm. which is the two-faced sort of the god of beginnings.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So like, there's so much shit. Like it's the. For a movie that's all about layers that you can see through, there's also layers that you can like look for, but that are never central to the plot. They're all just hints.
Right.
And there was another thing. You know what I loved?
Yeah.
When it's finally revealed, but we're talking before it's revealed that Andy is her sister.
Yeah.
When they're out on the steps before she gets shot.
Yeah.
Benoit yells something, something Helen.
Yeah.
He calls her Helen. And at first I was like, did I forget this character's name?
Yeah.
And then it goes back and does the rewind and you sort of realize it. And I'm like, there's so many tiny things that permeate all of the dumb things. I just really love it. And when a movie does things like this, I'm willing to forgive more things that I would consider sort of like off or not my cup of tea filmmaking.
Yeah. Like what?
So the ending, I feel like, was really, like, when she's smashing all of the things and the build-up and the slow and whatever. Like, part of me was like, I know where this is going. Let's just do it. Why is this? Why? Why is this taking so long? This is filmed kind of, like, straightforward, and I don't understand. Like, I'm a little bit bored. Like, I know the ending now. Let's go.
Right.
But then the more I thought about it, it takes almost the exact amount of time. I think I need to time this. Of Ed Norton's speech to Andy in the group when you start by breaking small things.
Yeah.
And people get into it because they want them broken.
Yeah.
And like, I just, and they go through the entire thing and it really, until you get to the thing that nobody wants you to break. And are you going to go through it? Like,
yeah.
And so like things like that, people were, I was getting into discussions with folks. They're like, it's just so stupid. That's not how explosions work. Like, and yeah, everyone's fine with the explosion and there's a HVAC system or whatever. But again, that's not how explosions work. Like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, I it's also like I've seen a movie before. Like I'm here for the I described it to Jamie. This movie sets you up for the most like metatextual I call them shock absorbers. If it's a vehicle,
yeah.
Like it's giving you the comfiest ride so that when you hit bumps, or this is me personally, I don't care. I'm just like, ooh, okay, mm-hmm. Let's keep going.
Yeah.
I don't know. This movie's great. It's so weird to talk about because we can go back and forth around a lot of different things because I think, how do I put it? The complexities of this movie, complexities highlight how stupid and simple things can be.
I loved the tell sign was, you know, again, a thing that Johnson is really good at is the use of language. Going back to Brick, his first film, which really crafted an entire new language, or, you know, basically grafted the language of film noir onto a high school in a really clever and complicated way. It was really telling that that Benoit's revelation about who Miles is has to do with language and the mm-hmm. way he uses language. And he was like, yeah, these are not the right words you're using here. And
some of them aren't really words.
Some of them aren't really words. And there are simpler ways to express what you're doing. And that actually caught me right off guard because I think, there, you know, like the sort of brilliant thing there is that when he said the word inbreviate, I actually was like, you know, there was a part of me that went, oh, is that a word? I guess so. I guess it's a word. Maybe yeah. it is. And then when it gets called out later on in the film, you're like, oh yeah, no, I'm playing into exactly the thing about this character that all these characters are playing into. And I think it's done with a kind of, you know, again, Johnson is he's a big fan of If for Fake. It's one of his favorite movies mm-hmm. of all time. And he talks about how the great thing about If for Fake is that it's a magic trick. And what Orson Welles does is he does the best thing that magicians do, which is that he distracts you and only to reveal the truth later on.
Yeah.
And so what Johnson does in that moment is he just like slides past that without even like anyone flinching or any, you know, like reaction shot to say, was that a word? You know, like nobody suggests anything. And it's only Benoit who later on comes across it. And there's also this like great thing, which is that to the beginning, you know, I haven't seen Benoit Blanc in a year or so. You're like, oh, was he this sort of like Southern hokum kind of thing?
That's the thing. Yeah. I didn't. So the first half of the movie, I'm like, they really fucking Colonel Sandered him the fuck up. And he seemed like kind of bumbly and silly.
Yeah, yeah. And also like, because we didn't know why he was at the party. Because again, Johnson, like a great magician, doesn't reveal to us how he got the box until later on. You know, he misdirects it as though somebody else sent him the box.
Yeah.
And of course, it couldn't be Andy because we saw her destroy the box. So the whole time we're thinking someone else is on this until later on it's revealed that it was actually Andy's box that ended up in his position. It made me think though that
the thing I really like about this sort of thing is everything that I didn't like initially, like there was something that rubbed me the wrong way about this movie, paid off in a plot way. I didn't like that they were making Benoit Blanc kind of like a fuddy-duddy sort of thing, but he was a fish out of water, and we eventually learned that. He's not like, he's famous detective, but he's not fucking mega rich. We see him and his husband roommate, Hugh Grant.
No, his husband.
Husband. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But it's revealed he even says to Helen when they're concocting their plan, he's like, I'm just going to play up the Southern, declare. I'm like, that's great. He's playing a role. Like, they always pay off the thing where I'm like, well, that doesn't quite, oh. Like, it's really rough.
I also loved how he completely disarmed. There is a couple things on reflection that are dumb, but at the same time, kind of like, this is a movie that is well aware of, like, the limits of its silliness.
Yeah.
And is like, it's fine. You know, like, the fact that Andy, as far as Miles is aware, turns up at the party, you know, and the world's famous detective is there as well. Probably major alarm bell should be going off on this guy in this guy's heads to the point where, like, you know, he's just murdered this person, right? Like, that's the reveal of the film.
The only thing that he can do, and you kind of read it on his face. I went back and looked at some scenes.
Yeah.
You can kind of read it on Edward Norton's face. When Andy shows up,
yeah,
he, like, looks flabbergasted. And at first you're like, oh, because he's the one that she ripped off. He ripped off. And he even like touches her lightly and like touches her away. And it's almost like he's like checking if she's real.
Yeah.
Also, the news has not reported that she's dead. So in his eyes, he thinks that he tried to poison her and she lived at that point because he didn't know that she had a twin sister.
Right.
Benoit Blanc being there is weird. And the reason why I think it kind of sets itself up and he kind of gets himself into sort of not teaming up with, but being okay that Benoit is there is because Benoit Blanc sort of reveals to him when he calls him into his office, like, you're setting yourself up. You're making a murder mystery party surrounded by people that probably want to kill you. And he's probably thinking, oh, Andy lived and Andy wants revenge. And that's why this is here. Benoit, you need to figure out who and how I'm going to get, like, attacked or killed.
Right.
So, like...
We're doing a lot of logical leaps to get to the point. Right?
I don't even think they're leaps. Like, I think this is a strength of the actors.
Yeah.
And the direction. I think that this stuff is played out across facial expressions and cadences and mood. I don't think I'm pulling these sort of scenarios out of nowhere. I think we're being teed up.
Then why did to clarify, why does Miles kill Duke?
Oh gosh. Because Miles, oh man. I remember this not bothering me in the moment, but it was kind of one of the least interesting things, so I don't quite remember.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot going on.
It's quite a leap to kill Duke, right? Like Duke is not the is one
did
of the
he find out about the whiskey plot? Whiskey being Duke's girlfriend.
No, because Whiskey is trying to get Duke onto his network, right? Onto what is the company called?
Whatever, the Alpha News.
Yeah, Alpha News' network. It doesn't, and then
there's a reason. And email us in onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. I don't even think this is a complex thing. I think it was just. Again, I want to rewatch this movie.
But yeah, why does he kill Duke? Like, it seems like it's a real, it's a big leap.
Oh, I know why. Duke was the only one that saw him drive away from Andy's house. They call that, I think Benoit actually calls that out.
Right.
Duke was the, because Duke is the one who says, oh, I saw, you almost pancaked
you
me
almost
on the thing.
Me, like at Anderson Cooper's party.
Or like whatever, you know, and Miles says, oh, and Anderson Cooper's
party.
Yeah,
I know, that was the deflection.
Yeah, because at that point, because everything's sort of starting to fall apart because when Duke shows him the news story that Andy's dead, and he's like, this changes everything, right? This could kind of get me onto the news. Because they're having a conversation, Miles and Duke, that is admitting that Duke knows that something's weird and going on, and that Miles killed Andy because Duke saw the body. Like, all the other friends got there and saw the body, so they're weirded out too.
Right.
So
at this point, has Andy been killed? The Andy in that Helena is playing?
I don't remember.
So like
probably.
I don't think
it doesn't. It doesn't matter one way or the other.
No, because they're still partying, and he hands her. You know, he hands Duke the drink, which has got pineapple juice in it. It's so dumb. It doesn't bother me, but it's like, at the same time, it's like, it's able to be hand waved away because Johnson's such a good writer.
And because he's written Miles as being dumb.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
And he's written Benoit to be bad at deducing dumb shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's not good at Cluedo. As it turns out.
Yeah. And he sucks at Among Us. When he was playing with what? Kareem Abdul-Jabbar,
Stephen Sondheim,
Angela Lansbury, and Natasha Lyonne.
Yeah. This is great.
Natasha Lyonne, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I also, you know, like the night before, we actually threw on No Time to Die beforehand. We were just looking for something to watch. And it popped up on Amazon Prime. So we threw that on. And I think, you know, there has been this thing, which is that it is very evident that Daniel Craig really grew tired of the Bond role, even though it's a massive thing. It also felt like there's just not a lot of muscle to stretch there, you know, for him. You know, he's a great theater actor. He's a great actor. He's a great raconteur of dialogue, you know? So like, I think something like this, it was just a fun place for him to stretch his wings. And then this also gave Janelle Monáe an extraordinary chance to like stretch as well, like Ana de Armas did in the first film.
Well, Janelle Monáe though has stretched she's quite a bit.
But we know her as a singer. And,
no,
and
she's. I think I've, at this point, I know her more as an actress.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's funny I say that right now, and I don't remember a lot of the roles, but she's been in a decent amount, and she's always in ensemble shit.
Right. She. I mean, she's great in Moonlight.
Yep.
You know, like amazing in Moonlight, but like I think. Maybe it's because I filmed a concert with her once, and I got to, you know.
I love Janelle Monáe, and her music's fucking great.
Yeah, yeah.
She's a wonderful performer.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think just a great stretch for it to see Kate Hudson come back in, like, a real fun. You know, like, there's a New York Times article right now, or a New Yorker article, the Nippo Babies. Have you seen
no.
this? Oh, the front page cover called Nippo Babies, about, like, nepotism babies. And Kate Hudson is on that cover. And I love that, you know, and oddly... her reaction to it is probably one of the strange ones. But like a friend of mine, the Tice, who was with us watching the film, he made this observation, and so I want to give him full credit for this. He was like, "Oh, her mother's Goldie Hawn, who is in the film Bird on a Wire, and her name in this movie is Birdie."
Yeah.
And I was just like, "That's great. I love the gag when she says, I just have to warn you, this is one of the worst sweatshops in." On the marketplace. Sounds perfect, Dad. You didn't think sweatshops meant that's where they make sweatpants, do you?
Yeah. It's so good.
It's what I love is that all of this is a play on language. You know, it's all of it is a beautiful, the metaphor and the symbolism is right on the surface. But it's also like, it's one of those things where it's like, it's like an academic lesson. It's teaching you these things as you're doing them. And it's very self-aware of what it's trying to say and what it's trying to do. And it's doing it so well. And it's doing it by someone who really understands, like, the history and how to write a murder mystery and how to peel it back. And, you know, like, it's someone who's well-versed in Murder, She Wrote, you know, like that sort of thing. So I think this is just so much fun. And it is that point that you kind of, you know, like you said... It's fun. It's fun. It's silly, but it's not stupid.
Yeah, it's. There are stupid things. Silly doesn't have to be stupid, even when the topic matter is stupidity.
Yeah.
Like, and again, layers, glass onion. Back to the title. Yeah. And it just shows the kind of hubris from all different sides of characters too. Like Lionel, and Catherine Hahn's character. They're like. On the other side of the coin, but are still bad. Like, they're still, like, you know.
They do get a little lost. I love Catherine Hahn, and she gets a little lost.
She gets a little lost. And Lionel, as the scientist who develops the thing and, like, wants the testing. Like, they strike me as the type of person that latch onto this billionaire sort of, like, icon sort of thing for the right reasons and think that they can maneuver through it, and they just can't.
Yeah, they're a little bit smarter than Duke.
Yeah. Duke is just on it for... I don't fucking know. Selling rhino boner pills.
I'm just one last thing. I love the little detail, which is that Miles is dressed as Tom Cruise's character from Magnolia.
Yes.
When they meet him for the first time, he's wearing the same outfit.
In the Glass Onion Bar.
Yeah, in the Glass Onion Bar. But it also, you know, reveals that he kind of takes his identity from elsewhere and, like, reads the wrong lessons in things. It's great.
It's a really smart movie.
Yeah.
I hope this
it's
podcast...
smart and silly.
Yeah.
It's silly, but with smarts behind
it. It's a movie about dumb things that is silly that is very smart.
Yeah. Which is fantastic.
Yeah. I hope you've enjoyed us just gushing over this thing.
Yeah.
Again, I still say any flaw that I see in it is like this weird, like, is the air quotes explosions don't work like that, to which I would just say, like, none of this works like that. Yeah. Like, I don't know.
It also seems like it'd be like, you know, Ethan Hawke appearing for like one scene. Yeah. I think everyone's going to want to be in one of these at some point, you know, like, and it's like a vacation movie they can take to any country kind of thing.
This is, everyone felt in this movie like they were just fucking having a great time.
Yeah.
Like, if you can see, like, emotions of actors permeating under their characters, everyone just seemed like they were loving this.
Yeah.
And that's a lovely feeling to experience, just even if it's under the surface. So, hey, kudos, Rian Johnson. Thank you for this and from getting out from under Star Wars.
We tip our hat to
yes.
You.
This has
this
has not quite been yet the thing.
I think he would happily do another Star Wars. I want to make this clear. I don't think he did Star Wars for the money. I think he loves Star Wars.
I think he loves Star Wars. I think he was excited that they told him he could take it in a new direction and to then have them rip it away and put it back to the fucking same Garbo shit that we're used to. It's only starting to get back on track with Andor, which I have not finished yet, but I've been really enjoying because it doesn't have to do with Jedi, at least until, I don't know, I'm halfway through. We'll see. Anyway, this has been the only podcast about Glass Onion, a Knives Out story. Mystery. A Knives Out mystery. Shahir, when you are not deducting the clues of stupid things played smartly for silliness, where can folks find you?
You can find me inebriating my languaging skills at my place of thinking at my website, www.shahirdaud.com. That's S-H-A-H-I-R-D-A-U-D.com. Matt, when you are making all the appropriate deductions on your tax returns, where can people find you?
You can find me submitting my 1099s over at my website at matthewkrol.com. My life and works. Also Skeletor, the number 4, PREZ on Instagram or PSN, or Emperor MSK on Twitter, if that's still a thing. Next week,
there's so much out. There's so much good stuff. There's so much. The Banshees of Inisherin is on. Decision to Leave, the Park Chan-wook film. Bardo is available. There's so much good stuff to see. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Here's my question.
Yeah.
Are we going to continue our tradition of talking about our best movies of 2022 a month later each time? Does that put us like in April?
Yeah, we're in April we'll go after the Oscars.
Fuck.
We think we have to. At this point, there's how many movies have we not seen?
I just feel like... I have so many questions. Okay, email us in, onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. For all of your thoughts on Glass Onion, did you hear something that we said that you didn't think of? Is there stuff that we missed that you'd like to tell us? Email us in about where and when you listen to us. Again, not specific locations, type of things you
do. It's on the toilet.
And email us in about, do you like hearing our machinations so late in the year of the next year about the previous year? Or would you rather...
Is machinations the right word?
Thoughts?
Yeah. Our thoughts about the
I like machinations.
Machinations? Yeah. Machinations is like the machinery of how we come to a decision.
Hearing the is that not the fucking episode?
Well,
it's literally us arguing about why we're putting movies in places, then you eventually saying, well, like, these movies could be in any list order. And I'm like, fuck you. And then we go, that's the machination of that episode.
Is it? I don't know if that's the right word you want to use there.
The Machiavelli, I'm trying to think malnutritious.
But the thing you were getting at is not like how we do the episode. The thing you were getting at is how late we do the episode because of.
Yes. I want to know if people like that or would like it earlier.
Okay. That's a fair question.
That's it. Email us in the answers. That's all your homework.
Because I always override and say, no, we got to get these movies in.
And look, I understand why you want to do it. We only can do one movie a week, and we get interrupted by things like Avatar.
Yeah.
And I get it. I get it. It's just I only have so much brain pan space, and it slowly gets filled up.
Brain pan space.
Yeah. Yeah.
Brain pan.
Brain pan.
I'm imagining this pan, which is like, what do they have in the hospital? In the hospitals, like the bid pans.
Yeah. It's a bridge for brains.
Yeah. Brid pan brain.
Anyway.
Brid pan.
hope you're baking good bread in your
brain pans.
Pan.
In your pan's labyrinth.
Burn the Mona brain. Lisa.
Yeah.
You're an overrated piece of shit.
Pop star. We should just do pop star again.
All right. Bye, everybody. Everyone.